Thank you for tuning in to this Thursday edition of the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm your host, Lori Boyer. In the show today, Vicki Boyd will have a report on a long-term study on reduced tillage, as well as more recent efforts to reward growers who adopt reduced disturbance systems. And Taylor Charleston will be along. He'll talk about the importance of identifying and reporting weedy rice. And I'll have a look at regional and national agricultural news, beginning with regional ag news, right after this word from our sponsor.
There's giant potential sleeping in your soil. Under drought conditions, it's never been more important to wake it up. Phycoterra, a superior soil microbial food, activates the native microbes responsible for your soil's health and water-holding capacity. Adding Phycoterra to your crop increases water retention up to 10% and optimizes crop nutrient availability. Plus, it delivers excellent mixability and application flexibility, making it easy to add to your existing crop input strategy. Visit phycoterra.com to learn how you can wake up your soil's giant potential with Phycoterra.
California Department of Food and Agriculture Secretary Karen Ross is congratulating Craig Haynes on his retirement. She says Craig has been a friend and an asset for all of his 29 years with CDFA, including 22 years with the Pierce's Disease Program virtually since its inception. Haynes' career with the department began as a trapper in Orange County for the Plant Health and Pest Prevention Services Division, working his way up the ladder on projects including Medfly and Mexfly, quarantines, Carno Bunt, and red imported fire ant. After joining the Pierce's Disease Control Program, Haynes also shared his expertise and experience by covering leadership positions on an interim basis with the department's plant health and citrus offices. He said he learned so much when he came to the Pierce's Disease Program in 2000, when they were essentially building a new program from the ground up. Haynes said that he credits Bob Wynn, his predecessor, as statewide coordinator, as his most impactful mentor and role model. He was just doing his job, but it was an honor to be able to watch him work with growers and colleagues throughout the government and industry, according to Haynes. Duarte Nursery of Houston stopped selling defective pistachio trees in 2014, but litigation over the matter goes on. Several plaintiffs have claimed the nursery did not disclose a genetic disorder that caused more than 500,000 trees to grow poorly. The defendants include company president John Duarte, who is running for Congress in the November 8th election. Judge John Freeland ruled in the growers' favor in Stanislaus County Superior Court in March, but has yet to hear arguments on monetary damages. The ruling cites at least $8.8 million in losses claimed by the growers. The disorder is called Bushy Top Syndrome, previously unknown in the pistachio belt from Merced to Kern counties. The biggest claim loss was one plaintiff who bought 409,500 trees for orchards in Tulare and Kern counties. Byte Kitchen, a restaurant technology company that scales independent restaurants through Notary Digital Food Halls, has announced the closing of a $6 million funding round and the opening of a second Notary location in San Carlos, California. The capital that was to be used will now be utilized to expand locations, invest further in technology, and grow the team. Byte Kitchen's mission is to empower independent restaurants to expand their footprint nationally without incurring capital investment or operational risk. By partnering with Byte Kitchen, restaurants unlock access to entirely new customer bases and additional revenue streams. Since Byte Kitchen first opened its digital food hall in San Mateo, California in December of 2021, thousands of customers have eagerly embraced the menu selections from Notary's collection of restaurant partners. A family can now mix and match a plantain burrito, a hummus chicken bowl, and a cheeseburger for a single dinner, ensuring a seamless experience without added time, stress, or delivery fees. The resounding success of the first Notary location with both restaurant partners and customers has led to quick expansion with the second location. CEO of Byte Kitchen, Divyang Arora, explains that independent restaurants are at the heart of local communities. They started Byte Kitchen to amplify their reach across the nation. However, in a market saturated with ghost kitchens and virtual brands, I believe quality is what will win in the long run. A bacterial species closely related to the deadly citrus greening disease is rapidly evolving its ability to infect insect hosts and possibly plants as well. It is a newly identified species belonging to the Liberector, a family of bacteria known to infect several economically important crops. There are 9 known Liberector species, including one that affects potatoes and 3 that are associated with citrus greening. Citrus greening, also known as Huanlongbing, is the number one killer of citrus trees worldwide. Though many are working on solutions, there is presently no effective prevention or treatment option on the market. Given its relatives as destructive qualities, UC Riverside scientists set out to understand the ways of the new species. As with new strains of COVID-19, bacteria becomes variants of concerns if their mutations can impact pathogenic or transmissible properties, according to Allison Hansen, UCR entomologist and study lead.
The Crop Consultant Conference returns on September 28th and 29th in Visalia, California. Co-hosted by Progressive Crop Consultant Magazine and the Western Region Certified Crop Advisors Association, this two-day conference features two concurrent CE tracks for both PCAs and CCAs. Earn the DPR and CCA credits you need. Network on our trade show floor and join us in giving away scholarships and honorariums presented by Western Region CCA, including the CCA of the Year Award. Visit progressivecrop.com/conference.
Vicki Boyd is in, where she talks about a long-term study on reduced tillage as well as more recent efforts to reward growers who adopt reduced disturbed systems. Here's Vicki with that report.
Jeff Mitchell, a cooperative extension specialist in plant science, has conducted research comparing conventional tillage to blocks planted to cover crops or ones that received reduced or no tillage since 1999. Initially, the studies at the Westside Research and Extension Center focused on reducing dust particles because of poor air quality within the San Joaquin Valley. As they progressed, he said they began looking at how the different practices affected soil health, soil microorganisms, and other physical properties of the soil.
It's been something I dare say has been near and dear to me. A lot of work and toil and trouble have gone into that project there. But we really began way, way back in 1999. And that was the first year that we established the systems or the experimental treatments there. And we were a group, and still are to this very day, actually, of many different partners, including a number of farmers who have been intimately involved with this project over the years. Of course, university colleagues from up north in Davis, and also locally here in Fresno County, where the site is, but also an awful lot of private sector and government agency people. So it's been a kind of a multi-partnered endeavor that started off, frankly, in the old days. If you remember, at that time anyway, in the San Joaquin Valley, air quality was a big issue, and particularly PM or dust emissions, and the high levels of dust that were exceeding US EPA standards in certain times of the year there. That was a big emphasis of the work early on. So what we tried to do in those early days was just quantify the amount of dust that was generated by conventional cropping systems for tomato and cotton, and then for what we called reduced disturbance tillage systems that didn't work up the soil as much. And it's not surprising, but early on, the results show that you could, if you reduce disturbance of the soil, you could reduce dust emissions by 75 or 80% there. So it's not a very surprising outcome, but it was a significant one. And it showed, a useful benefit out of that. Then as we continued the study and saw the value of, dogging the implementation and keeping it going, we started focusing on other things like soil health, soil quality, changes in different soil properties and soil function, the economics, the productivity, and other dimensions there.
About the same time, a group of progressive farmers began implementing some of the cover crop and reduced tillage practices on their own operations. They wanted to improve water infiltration and water retention. Mitchell described them as bold because the transition wasn't easy and the growers had a lot at risk.
Early on, and really at the very beginning of this century, in 2001 and through 2003, there were some farmers that were quite interested in what we were doing. And they themselves started doing some of these cover crop and reduced disturbance tillage systems and techniques at their own farms. And that was really exciting. It was very bold on their parts. There were people that were actually beginning to implement some of these practices. And they were frankly trying to do it to improve the water movement or the quality of their soil in drip irrigated fields there by adding cover crops and reducing disturbance. So that was really an exciting first line of farmer involvement in this kind of work. And, they were very, I say bold, because they were facing some challenges. It was not easy to do these systems. It was new. The risks were high. The learning curve issues had to be handled and negotiated. And there was a fair amount of risk that was involved in those days.
Mitchell said he's excited about a more recent project that involves organic farmers who are trying to add the reduced tillage component to their operations. Since they can't use synthetic herbicides, organic farmers typically turn to tillage for weed control. But trying to reduce that practice comes with a host of challenges.
The group that we're working on more currently is equally or perhaps even more exciting. And it's involved a group of all organic farmers. And they include everyone from a farmer down in Madera County, Tom Willie, who you probably know very well. Another outstanding farmer over in Hollister, California, Phil Foster. Scott Park up in Meridian, California, and his son, Brian Park. And then over in Gwinda, California, Full Belly Farms with Paul Muller and Andrew Brate. And all of these folks are just state-of-the-art, exceptionally well-experienced farmers, top-notch farmers in California, for sure, with probably 35 to 45 years of experience with organic farming under their belts there. So it's been really an exciting project to work with them. But the big challenge that they have gotten hold of now is to try to add the component of reduced disturbance tillage into their organic systems. So cutting out or eliminating or reducing tillage disturbance in an organic system is really challenging. How do you do that without chemicals? How do you do that without lots of tillage implements going through the field there? They're interested in improving soil function, the overall performance of their system. And dare I say, to a person, I think they're also trying to emulate what we might call natural systems. You know, Mother Nature doesn't do tillage per se.
Reduced tillage is huge in three major South American countries, with Paraguay using the system on about 99% of its ground. In the United States, Tennessee, for example, uses reduced tillage or conservation tillage on 85% of cotton ground. In California, however, the practice was used on less than 0.5% of the acres based on a 2004 survey. By 2012, Mitchell said certain sectors, such as dairy silage production, had adopted reduced tillage to a much greater extent. In this case, he said at least 45% of the acres are under some type of reduced disturbance system. One reason for the lack of adoption is the higher value of specialty crops within the state and the associated risk. But he said he's seeing the needle slowly moving toward less disturbance.
Well, I think, first of all, the risk is very great. California annual cropping systems not only involve the standard row crops and field crops like wheat, barley, corn, cotton, sorghum, those lesser value crops, but annual cropping systems here in California also involve a great range of specialty crops, the vegetables and the higher valued crops that not only are more expensive to produce. The budgets, the production budgets are much higher than, you know, growing corn for grain or for silage would be, but the risks are greater as well. The seeds are oftentimes very small, very delicate. The seedlings are delicate. Farmers have come to rely over the last 90 or 100 years in the Central Valley since irrigation began on a whole litany or series of tillage operations that prepare very fine, beautiful, well aggregated and sized soil seed beds that allow for productive growth of crops that they seed into those seed beds there. So the risk, the high value nature of some of the annual specialty crops, the fact that until recently equipment was not available locally in California to accomplish these kind of reduced disturbance practices, the fact that there hasn't been the expertise, the local on the ground support in terms of private sector consultants and equipment people who knew about how to do it, how to pull it off, that has changed rapidly over the last 5 or 6 years, I'd say.
Until about 10 years ago, Mitchell said the thought was that less soil disturbance allowed for greater carbon storage within the soil. But more recent science has put some of those beliefs in question.
Until recently, and recently by that I mean about the last 10 years of science, the dogma or the theory was that if you reduce disturbance, you're probably also likely to be storing more carbon in the soil. That has really come under more focused attention in recent years. And I think it's fair to say that the science really doesn't really bear that out in all cases and all environments. And by that, I mean that what happens is that a lot of times, if you do no tillage or reduce disturbance, you tend to get an enrichment in carbon or organic matter in the surface soil level, the top 6 inches or 15 centimeters, maybe a little bit deeper. But below that, you end up depleting the soil of carbon because you're not mixing the soil layers that you would with plowing and disking and everything. So the science has really, uncovered this kind of a fact here that maybe unless you add deliberate organic material amendments like cover crops and compost, you may not, in actuality, end up storing more carbon in the soil with no-till. The reason for that is because the organisms in the soil, the microorganisms, they, as soon as carbon is available to them, they're going to eat that. They're going to decompose that carbon. They're going to grow. Their populations will increase. They'll respire that and it'll all be cycled in the soil system and also eventually into the atmosphere as well. But it's more like not so much a recognition that sequestration of carbon long-term is happening in these soils, but rather the cycling of carbon is different. There may be more of that. It may be more leading to more resilience in the soil. But I think we have to be careful about pinning too much hope on these practices to really store over the long haul more carbon in deep soil layers there.
Mitchell said he remains hopeful based on changes he sees in the marketplace as buyers and consumers are paying more attention to their food systems. For the past 2 years, he's been loosely involved with the Regen One project, bringing together different players within Northern California agriculture. For growers who can validate adoption of regenerative practices, the goal is to have the marketplace reward them for their efforts.
I do think that there is a lot of momentum, not a lot, but there is certain momentum right now. And it is certainly more definite, more pronounced, and more real, I think, than ever before, that buyers, that consumers, that the marketplace itself is beginning to be more positioned and poised and expecting, our food systems to be operating in certain ways there. So what is happening now? And this is kind of I hope this is an exciting new frontier here that I've been at least peripherally involved with for the last 2 years, I think. There are efforts afoot, and particularly in Northern California, I'm aware of one project that has brought together a lot of, organizing people, marketplace people who are bringing together buyers, aligning them with farmers who are willing to step up and demonstrate that they are making changes in terms of soil health implementation practices and outcomes that can be monitored and measured. And to bring all these parties together into a system or a program, I guess, where farmers will be rewarded for the kinds of improved performance practices that they are using there. And it has to be monitored. It has to be validated and accounted for there. What I'm trying to say here is that there is also paralleling that marketplace increase in interest in these kind of practices in the food system in general. There is a growing cadre of farmers who are recognizing that market opportunity and starting to say, okay, well, how can I get into that? How can I become certified or validated in some form? Much as organic was in the last 40 or so years, there are now what are called regenerative ag certification programs that are coming up. And the one in Northern California, you can look on the internet, it's actually called Regen One, R-E-G-E-N, and the digit or the number one. It is on the verge, from what I understand, of being launched as a final or a formal mechanism that brings all these people together.
Soil was not created overnight, and benefits of practices that improve soil quality will take years to begin to be noticed. But as more equipment and on-the-ground expertise becomes available in the state, Mitchell said he expects more growers to at least dip their toes into practices that reduce soil disturbance. This is Vicki Boyd reporting for My Ag Life.
Do you know the nutrient use efficiency people? Yes, I'm talking about the folks at Verdesian Life Sciences that deliver crop insights and solutions so California crops grow to their full potential. From micros with a proprietary delivery system to solutions that help improve the uptake and assimilation of applied nutrients. visit VLSCI.com to learn more about Verdesian Solutions or to connect with a local representative right here in California.
President Joe Biden earlier this week signed into law the Inflation Reduction Act, a bill focusing on climate change and health care that includes significant spending for USDA conservation and rural renewable energy programs. The $739 billion overall spending act includes $369 billion for various programs tied to renewable energy and reducing greenhouse gases throughout the economy. The climate provisions in the law will help to lower U.S. greenhouse gas emissions 40% below 2005 levels by the year 2030. Biden, in signing the law, called the bill the most aggressive action ever in confronting climate crisis and strengthening energy security. He said this law would lead to 9 million new jobs in clean energy manufacturing, including solar and wind farms, hydrogen projects, and electric batteries and vehicles. The president also pointed to the 15% minimum corporate income tax, saying that wealthy and big corporations will finally begin to pay part of their fair share. The legislation faced unanimous opposition from congressional Republicans. Among the complaints, GOP lawmakers said the spending on USDA programs will make it harder to negotiate a farm bill next year. The $19.5 billion for USDA conservation programs will incentivize more farmers to adopt cropping and livestock practices that reduce greenhouse gas emissions, reduce nitrogen loss, or sequester carbon in the soil. Ag and Finance Panel Senator Chuck Grassley says it's unlikely Biden's nominee for U.S. Chief Ag Negotiator will buck the president's anti-free trade agreement policy, though Grassley says Doug McCallop could boost existing deals. Grassley says McCallop could speak out against the president's direction to his trade officials not to do market-opening trade deals.
Well, if he wants to be irritable and confrontational, he can do some good by letting people know that he's concerned about agriculture and trade deals and the importance of free trade to agriculture.
But will he?
I don't think he would dare have that kind of courage, but if he did have it, he could make a big difference. And even if he didn't change any policy, he would at least know that the interests that he represents are being heard at the highest levels.
McCallop told Grassley and the Finance Committee at his Senate confirmation hearing,
I wouldn't be taking this job, I wouldn't be interested in it, if I didn't think I could make a difference for farmers.
Callup insists, if confirmed, he'll push to expand ag trade in the UK, the Indo-Pacific, Latin America, and parts of Africa. A new challenge could include China, still short of its phase one commitments, but now cooling relations with the U.S. over Taiwan. The National FFA organization has announced a record high student membership number of 850,823. That's an increase of 15% from last year. In addition, chapter numbers increased by 178, resulting in 8,995 chapters in the United States, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. Interest in FFA and agriculture education continues to grow as membership and the number of chapters increase. The top five student membership states are Texas, California, Georgia, North Carolina, and Tennessee. This year, the organization has more than 132,700 Latino members, more than 47,000 Black members, and more than 13,000 American Indian and Alaska Native members. Further, 43% of the membership is female, 50% is male, with 0.5% reporting as non-binary, 4.7% were undisclosed, and 1.2% unreported. Extreme heat is expected to remain during the late summer in the West, with potential impacts to agriculture and to wildfires. USDA Ag News reporter Rod Bain.
While some parts of the country are seeing autumn-like temperatures and weather conditions this week,
summer is making its last stand as you move to the West, and particularly in areas stretching from California through the Great Basin and into the Northwest.
With summertime heat, even record high temperatures, according to USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
And this is going to be something we expect to see for at least the next week.
And given the current heat and dryness in the region, agricultural concerns arise.
Any immature summer crops are going to experience varying degrees of stress from this heat and dryness. For irrigated crops, this means a boost in irrigation demands as we head into late summer.
Plus an elevated wildfire threat for the far west, already in its peak time of the summer wildfire season.
That's really the biggest threat in terms of heat and wildfires. Hot, dry weather expected to continue for the foreseeable future in those areas.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
An American Farm Bureau Federation survey shows that drought is hitting U.S. agriculture hard. Farm News reporter Chad Smith has more on the impacts.
The American Farm Bureau Federation distributed a third drought impact survey in June to its members in 15 states across the western U.S. Danny Munch, an economist with Farm Bureau, said the survey was distributed to state staff, county and state leadership, and farmer and rancher members.
The survey included several demographic questions to distinguish state affiliation and had sections on crop-specific factors, livestock factors, and general water access. By the end, we received over 650 responses from those 15 states, and it got a whole bunch of data on operational-level changes that farmers and ranchers were doing to cope with drought.
The major takeaways from the survey show farmers are continuing to battle severe drought conditions.
Respondents expect their farm-related revenue to be down 38% from average because of drought. 74% reported an expected reduction in harvest yields. 66% reported liquidating parts of their herd or livestock herd. And 73% reported reduced surface water deliveries because of drought conditions. Many more farmers were tilling under crops and removing orchards compared to last year. And of those who reduced their herd size last year, half were continuing to liquidate.
He says communicating the impact of drought on agriculture is crucial to the conversation surrounding effective drought mitigation efforts.
A lot of data on drought impacts is often isolated. It's not uniform across the country, or it's just generally difficult to come by. So we at AFBF recognized the gap in data and decided to run our own survey. This is the third time as drought continues to persist. And that data provides useful insights on the operational level hurdle farmers and ranchers face in coping with that drought that's helpful in our communication efforts.
Chad Smith, Washington.
Sponsored by the California Walnut Board and Commission, supporting the industry with on-farm innovation through production research, advocacy for government programs, and driving consumer demand. Doing more together.
And now here's Taylor Charlstrom with a report about the importance of identifying and reporting weedy rice.
It's getting close to the time for rice growers to scout for weedy rice in their fields, and UC personnel will be reaching out to growers and PCAs in the next few weeks about this. The more eyes on the ground, the better, according to UCCE's Whitney Brim DeForest, and she's asking everyone to be on the lookout and report weedy rice due to the specific nature and species of the weed.
Weedy rice is kind of a strange weed as far as weeds go, because it's the same species as rice. So it's exactly the same species. There's nothing different about it. Eventually, what will happen is that if your field has weedy rice, it'll sort of end up taking over the field and becoming, your field will become primarily weedy rice and not the rice variety that you planted. And weedy rice tends to shatter. So instead of staying on the panicle until harvest, it'll be falling off into the field. And so the growers eventually won't be able to actually harvest most of their field because most of it will just end up back on the soil. So that's really the big problem. Yield losses in the south are around 70%. We don't have fields like that quite yet here in California, but some of our greenhouse data shows similar yield losses when we have really high densities.
Now is the perfect time to start scouting for weedy rice, especially if you've applied all herbicides to control grasses and you're still seeing what appears to be skips or misses in grass control. At that point, it's a good idea to go out and check the plants. If they do not have a ligule or an auricle, then they are a grass species and not weedy rice. And if they have a ligule and auricle, then they are either rice or spangletop.
The only thing that should be left in the field is either, you know, some weeds maybe that got missed or weedy rice. It is kind of hard to tell it apart from watergrass, one of our worst weeds of rice. They look very similar. The weedy rice will usually be above the rice canopy and the leaves are lighter in color, sort of again similar to the watergrass, unfortunately. But the key will be, like, if you see those leaves sticking up above the canopy and you're unsure if it's watergrass or rice, weedy rice, you've got to go out and actually check the plants. So we've told people to kind of feel the leaves. The leaves are rough. If it's weedy rice, they have what we call pubescence. So that's how you would tell it apart from a medium grain variety, one of our regular medium grain varieties. Watergrass, unfortunately, also has the same sort of pubescence feeling. So the next step would be to peel the leaf away from the stem and look at where the leaf meets the stem. And if it's rice, it'll have what we call a ligule and an auricle, which kind of to me looks like little fan-shaped appendage, I guess, sticking out from the where the leaf meets the rice. And also the like clasping arms, I guess, so to speak, around the rice stalk. So that's what you'll look for. So if it's watergrass, it won't have anything there at the leaf, at where the leaf meets the stem. It'll just be nice and smooth. So that's really the first step. At this point in time, some of the weedy rice might actually be starting to head. And so then you'll see the panicle sort of emerging up out of the plant. And at that point in time, you can do a potassium hydroxide test, and we can help with that. And that'll let folks know if it's red pericarp, if the rice has a red bran. And so far in California, all of our weedy rice has red bran. We have to just be careful that if it's in a commercial red rice variety field, that somebody call us out to look. So kind of depending on the situation, it's good to have a sort of a second set of eyes. And so they can feel free to call one of the farm advisors, myself or my colleague Luis.
So far this season, UC has had a couple of calls about weedy rice, likely related to the reduced overall acreage, and thus far all have been varietal contaminants. Nevertheless, any suspicion of weedy rice should be reported.
We've got an internal map that we keep. We don't publish the map, so people don't have to worry about it getting out that they have weedy rice. So Luis and I would come out to the field and take a sample. If we're not sure if it's weedy or not, we grow it out in the greenhouse, and then we'll let them know if it's weedy. It's sometimes a little bit unclear. That's why if it's an unclear case, we grow it out. And then to manage it, really, unfortunately, at this point in time, there's not a whole lot of management strategies that are chemical related. We do have one herbicide that we can use as a spot spray. And that's Suppress, which is a organic biopesticide. So that would be the only thing that they could use as a spot spray option at this point in time. But keep in mind that it does kill everything. So it would kill your rice as well. So it really needs to be a targeted application. The other thing to do is to pull it out of the field. So actually to take the plants and to pull them out of the field. And then those plants actually need to be taken all the way out of the field, unfortunately, because if they're left in the field, sometimes the seeds shatter and then you get actual weedy rice germinating. So we tell folks to take it all the way out of the field and actually throw it away. So it's kind of a lot of work. If they've headed out and it's too much work to pull all the plants out of the field, you can also just cut the panicles off the top of the rice. And that's a little bit easier. So cut them off into a bucket or something, and that'll prevent at least the seed from shattering into the field. And then we've got some winter management strategies and stuff as well. We've got our best management practices posted on our website. So, and of course, Luis and I are happy to walk people through sort of the best management practices for their particular situation.
Weedy rice is considered the most prolific weed in all rice fields across the world. But in California, it's less common. Still, any instance should be investigated, reported, and dealt with.
Luis and I have been doing surveys in the past few years, and we really only have about 3,000 acres that we would consider like badly infested. We've found it in more acres than that, but in most cases, it's been a plant or two, and folks have been able to get rid of it very quickly. But there are a couple of fields in California that they've had it for 20 years. So once it is established, it really persists. So that's why we keep harping on it and telling people that we need to manage for it. Because you don't want to have it in your field and be dealing with it for 20 years once it's, you know, well established. So it is a bad weed. It's, you know, again, the worst weed worldwide. But in California, I would say it's still not maybe, you know, as bad as, say, watergrass.
The UC Rice YouTube channel has recordings, virtual meetings, and webinars on how to identify weedy rice. For My Ag Life, I'm Taylor Chalstrom.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
That will wrap up today's show. You've been listening to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Lori Boyer. From all of us here at the JCS Marketing team, thank you for listening.